are tasked with trying to teach Hilchos Shabbos, where do you begin? Shabbos is so expansive, Shabbos is so important, and in many ways Shabbos is so intricate and so complicated. So where do we begin when we talk about Hilchos Shabbos? What would you say? Where should we begin? I think some would argue maybe we should talk about the halachos of Erev Shabbos, or the halachos of Kiddush, which is the very beginning, the entree of Shabbos, or Kabbalah Shabbos, or the very relevant question that comes up all the time. What happens if I'm part of a family where somebody's making early Shabbos, I'm still in the shower? Do I have to be considered as part of the family unit? Can I consider myself alone? Am I able to run by my own zman and my own rules? All of these different questions, but that is not the place to start. Why is it not the place to start? Because those are all specific details of the laws of Shabbos. But here what we're going to talk about is something that is, I think, the highest priority when we talk about Hilchos Shabbos, and that is, how do we deal with somebody who is in a pikuach nefesh situation on Shabbos? And you'll say, well, it never comes up. It does come up. Unfortunately, it comes up. And when it comes up, we don't have time to prepare adequately or to really go out of our way to understand how we should best handle it. So that's what I thought. The greatest way to start Hilchos Shabbos is by starting with the most important part of Hilchos Shabbos, and that is, how do we break Shabbos when we need to? And that is something that sounds counterintuitive, but I think it's the most important part that we need to focus on. Actually, the Sefer Mate Ephraim, which is all about various different halachos that talk about the Yom Narayim, in the Sefer Mate Ephraim, he writes that there are certain halachos that a more hora, that a rabbi, that somebody who paskin shilas, doesn't have time to look up. You're asked a question, you need to have the answer right away. For example, he says, when it comes to a question with regard to Kriyas HaTorah, we don't have time to start looking around. You're in shul, you're laning, some question comes up, you don't have a time to start flipping through all the different svarim and looking for the answer. You have to know the answer. And this is no different. He writes that when it comes to this, the Mishnah Berurah says, similarly, when it comes to the dinim of Chola B'Yom HaKippurim, and I can tell you, I've been in the Young Israel Woodmere 8 years now, there is not a Yom Kippur that has gone by where I have not been stopped in the middle of davening by someone who has ran in to come and ask a question about some family member who's not feeling well, somebody who needs something. And actually, just an interesting story. A couple of years ago, there was somebody who ran into shul. I was literally in the middle of Shemona Esrei, and he said, you know, my family member is really in a very serious situation. I need you to come. So I stopped my Shemona Esrei. I walked out of shul. I said, well, where is this person? He said, well, he's in our house. I walked like 10 minutes to his house, literally in the middle of davening. And this person was really, really sick. He was an elderly person. And I said to him, you know, I really think you need to take your medication, and your medication is not allowed to be taken without food, so you need to eat. And that's a very elementary halacha. That's not complicated at all. So I told him, you really need to eat. He says, I don't need to eat. I really don't need to eat. So I said, you know, I was just trying to be nice. He says, you're a little kid. Don't tell me what to do. I'm going to do what I want. So I said, you're right. I am a little kid. But you asked the rabbi to come over. So I listened to what you said, and I came, and you asked me a shaila. So this is the answer. I feel uncomfortable telling you what to do, but the Mishnah Berurah writes that when it comes to Chola B'Yom HaKippurim, that is another example of an area of halacha where we don't have time to start making all kinds of calculations and picking up the phone and looking up a sefer. You have to know how to handle it before the situation arises. Otherwise, you can run into a problem where you're going to make a very terrible and sometimes catastrophic mistake. So that's why I think when it comes to the din of Chola B'Shabbos, this also is something that we need to be very well aware of. And this is not only something that is limited to a rabbi. This is something that everybody needs to know, because you never know when you're going to be the person who is called upon to be involved in a life-saving activity. It could be anyone. You don't have to be a medical professional. You don't have to be the parent of the child. You can just be a friendly neighbor who happens to be there at any given time and is faced with a situation where you need to respond, where you need to react. So that is why I thought that this is the most important set of halachas to deal with. We're not going to be able to cover everything in one shiur. Amir Tzoshem, next week, we're going to have two more opportunities to meet before Rosh Hashanah, and I hope to continue that. So let's begin with a very important Gemara in Maseches Yuma. So the Gemara tells us in Maseches Yuma a lengthy discussion that the Gemara tries to prove, minayin the pikuach nefesh shadocha es haShabbos. How do I know that life-saving activity will be more important than Shabbos itself? So let's go through the Gemara. It's the Gemara Maseches Yuma, Rabbi Shmuel v'Rabbi Akiva v'Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah hayu mehalchem baderech. V'levi hisdir v'Rabbi Shmuel ben Osher v'Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah hayu mehalchem achareihem. Nishala, they had the following shaila that came up. How do we know that pikuach nefesh is Docha Shabbos? And the Gemara answers, now, by the way, that's an interesting question. The Gemara is making an assumption that Pikuach Nefesh is Docha Shabbos, right? And the Gemara says, how do you know it's true? Well, what made the Gemara have that assumption in the first place? Maybe Shabbos is more important than somebody's life. But the Gemara assumes, this is discussed actually in Achronim, but the Gemara assumes that Pikuach Nefesh is definitely Docha Shabbos. We're just not sure exactly how we know that. So Rabbi Yishmael gives some kind of very complicated answer. Rabbi Elazar comes along and he says, I'll tell you how I know. We know that Bris Mila is only one out of 248 limbs in a person's body, and yet, Docha es HaShabbos, if a child is born and the Bris Mila falls out on Shabbos, so we know that you violate Shabbos in order to observe the mitzvah of Bris Mila. If that is the case, then certainly, if my whole body is in danger, I'm allowed to save the entirety of the body and overlook Shabbos. That's the way he argues. Now the Gemara asks, if that's the case, then Ashkechan Vaday, I know for Bris Mila is going to be fulfilled on Shabbos, then I'm certainly going to be able to fulfill the mitzvah when I'm violating Shabbos. But how do we know about a suffix? What if I'm not exactly sure whether someone's life is in danger or perhaps that person is okay? How do I react then? That I cannot prove from Bris Mila. So the Gemara then says, let's come up with another idea. Pasuk says, Ach Shabsosai Tishmoru, Yachol Akol, you may think that you're supposed to observe Shabbos under all conditions, under all circumstances, says the Gemara. We have Xeris HaKasav that says, Ach Chilek. So you see here in the Gemara that the Gemara goes on a whole litany of different suggestions of how do we know that Pikuach Nefesh is Docha Shabbos. And it's not clear at all. The Gemara comes to the final conclusion, which is in the last line you'll see, where we're told, Ushmartem as chukosai ves mishpatai aser yasa osa ha'adam v'chai bahem. And the truth is, this pasuk has nothing at all to do with Shabbos. It has nothing at all to do with life either. When the Torah says v'chai bahem, it means what? What? No. So this, what's the simple? That's advanced Talmud. That's what the Gemara says it means. The simple reading of the pasuk actually means that we're talking about olam haba. If you keep the laws of the Torah, v'chai bahem, you will live on forever. You will have a portion in the world to come. And that is why we are encouraged to observe all the mitzvot HaTorah. But the Gemara here takes it on a different layer of interpretation. And the Gemara says that the pasuk v'chai bahem teaches us, v'chai bahem v'lo sheyamos bahem. We learn from there that we should try to live by the laws of the Torah. And one is not expected to give up their life for the sake of observing any mitzvah. And from here the Gemara learns a general principle that V'chai Bahem tells us that anytime you have a situation where my life is in danger because of my insistence on observing a mitzvah, I'm supposed to overlook the mitzvah and I'm supposed to look after my life. There can be so many examples of that, but as we're going to see, we have to really figure out when it applies and when perhaps it does not. There is a further discussion in the Rishonim. And the Rishonim say, well, many of us are familiar with the fact that the Gemara tells us that there are three exceptions to this rule. What are the exceptions? Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, and Shfichas Damim. That we assume that by those three situations, if a person's life is in danger, they are expected to give up their lives and not to violate the principle in the Torah. Number one, Avodah Zarah means if somebody literally puts a gun to my head and says that I would like you to serve Avodah Zarah, otherwise, the alternative is I'm going to kill you. So I'm expected to give up my life as not to serve Avodah Zarah. If somebody puts a gun to my head and says, I would like you to violate this very inappropriate activity, to be with this individual who you are not allowed to live with, and I want you to have a relationship with that person, otherwise, the alternative is that you're going to lose your life, the Gemara says I have to be willing to give up my life and not to violate that Avera. And the same goes for Shvichas Damim. If somebody puts a gun to my head and says, either you kill that person or I kill you, so the Gemara says, I have to be willing to give up my life as not to violate the Isser of Shvichas Damim. So the Rishonim have a discussion. What happens in a situation where we're talking about a regular mitzvah in the Torah? For example, we're talking about the mitzvah of eating kosher. So you have a situation where we're all expected to eat kosher food. Now what happens when you have somebody who comes and puts a gun to my head and says, either eat the non-kosher food or I'm going to kill you? What's the halacha? What? Not a trick. The halacha is you need to eat it. Not just you can, you need to eat it. You need to save your life. So the Rishonim discuss, what happens if I feel I am such a devout Jew, I love God so much, And I would never want to eat non-kosher food because I know what it's going to do to me. Timtum alev, it's going to make me impure, something's going to happen, terrible thing. I don't want to eat non-kosher food, doesn't matter what the consequence is. What would you say in a situation like that? Am I allowed to volunteer to give up my life because I don't want to eat the kosher food? So you say no. Why?
Because it's not a mitzvah to sacrifice himself.
Right, so that's what I would have said. That we have three exceptions to the rule. Barring those three exceptions, we go back to the rule, which is v'chai b'hem, that I'm always supposed to look after my own life, and I should not put my life in jeopardy regardless of how much I love God. This is not a reflection of my love or distaste for God, chas v'chalila. That's not what it is. It's God Himself told me the rules. And the Ribbono Shel Olam said, under all these circumstances, you are not obligated, and therefore you may not give up your life. That is the opinion of the Rambam. And the Rambam says that if a person chooses in such a situation to give up their life as opposed to violating the Avera, he's considered to be a Ma'abed Atzmo Ladas. It's as if you have committed suicide, and the Rambam says, Harei Zeh Mischayev Benafsho. Now that's hard to understand. What does it mean? It's as if you've committed suicide. You're dead already. So what's the difference? Right? Somebody says, eat the non-kosher sandwich or I'm going to kill you. I say, no, I want to be killed. The Rambam says, if you take that option and you're willing to be killed and you end up being killed, it's as if you committed suicide. What's the difference? You're not alive anymore. The difference is very significant. Hama'abed atzma ladas is ein lo chelek la'olam haba. Someone who commits suicide, and let me make it very clear. I actually was giving a shiur a couple of months ago and I said, someone who commits suicide, and a very thoughtful therapist called me up and said, it's really not the right way to say it. We say, when somebody commits a crime, that's when you commit something, you've done something wrong, you're committing a crime. Committing suicide is not a crime. Most often, the situations that we face today, which are so tragic when somebody does commit suicide, it's not because they're doing something wrong. They're not doing it out of spite or out of anger to the world. They're doing it because they have some kind of underlying issue that's forcing them to do that. Now, I'm not saying that they should get a pass, and I'm not saying that they should be excused for that behavior, but at the same time, we do need to look at it very differently. And I was not aware of the sensitivity that we no longer call it committing suicide, which I think is a very intelligent sensitivity. It's not called committing suicide. Nowadays, the way they refer to it is dying by suicide. But in this case, the Rambam says, this is committing suicide because you are choosing, you are electing to give up your life. Not because you have a mental illness, not because you are depressed, not because you're dealing with some other external factor that's pushing you to do so, but because you feel that instead of eating a non-kosher item, you're going to rather give up your life. And that, says the Rambam, is ma'abed atzma ladas, ve'ein lo chelek la'olam haba. And therefore the Rambam says, you have no right to volunteer. The Balei HaTosis disagree, and the Balei HaTosis feel, absolutely, if a person chooses that they want to volunteer to give up their lives instead of doing something that they're not allowed to do, go ahead. You have every right. It's your life. You can choose to do whatever it is that you'd like. So, the way in which the Shulchan Aruch talks to us about this issue should be very encouraging to all of us. Let's look. I'm sorry, it's not here. The Shulchan Aruch writes in Siman Shin Chaf Ches, that's Hilchos Shabbos, where he talks about all of the various details that govern Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos. And the Shulchan Aruch says, not only are you allowed to violate Shabbos in order to be able to save a life, but even you should feel encouraged to do so. And the same way, writes the Shulchan Aruch, it is a mitzvah to do so. So the same way we have a mitzvah to sit in sukkah, to blow the shofar, to daven every day, to do everything that we do, so too, says the Shulchan Aruch, this is a mitzvah. To spend your Shabbos saving someone's life as opposed to keeping Shabbos and letting someone's life be lost is considered to be a mitzvah. So much so that the Shulchan Aruch writes a little bit further in Siman Shin Chaf Ches, what if a person thinks that they are saving a life? But the truth is, I'm not a medical professional, I don't really have experience, and I don't know what I'm doing. So I jump in, I get in the car, I rush someone to the hospital, and it turns out, once I get there, the doctors and the nurses are laughing at me, you should have just put a Band-Aid on, this is nothing. Writes the Shulchan Aruch, if it turns out in the end that what I did was futile, if what I did was something that was unnecessary, but I thought at the time that I was doing something that was warranted, that was needed to save a life, writes the Shulchan Aruch, that too is considered to be a mitzvah, and there's nothing to feel bad about. There is no guilt, there is no harm there. So in fact, this is an extremely relevant, a little bit of a complicated shaila, that's relevant to members of Hatzalah. Let's read it together. Nishalti pa'amim rabos. It's here in number bays on the sheet. Ba'anshe hatzala shenikru lehatzil nifgei tu'una o chavala b'safek pikuach nefesh. So a call comes in on the Hatzala radio that there has been a terrible car accident and we need some members to come and clear up the scene and take everyone to the hospital. Okay. Now, the first member of Hatzala gets there, surveys what's going on, and he sees this is not a dangerous situation at all. There's nothing happening. Everything's under control. Everyone's fine. So what should he do? Should he radio back to all the other members and let them know you're no longer needed? Or should he continue leaving things as they are and the other members will come to the call? When they get there, they'll realize there's nothing going on. They'll get back in the car and go home. So what would you say? Now, it's not a very fair scenario. I'll tell you why. Because every time a member of Hatzala is driving through the streets with their lights and sirens on, it is a pikuach nefesh. And I just personally learned that the other day. I mean, I always knew that to be the case, but I was actually driving down Peninsula Boulevard in Woodmere, and it was late at night, and there was a ambulance that was like two blocks behind me, but I was so focused on my rearview mirror trying to figure out, like, you know, how close are they? Where am I supposed to be going? Should I move this way, that way? You know, sometimes you just get all nervous and flustered. And I like started going here, going there, and I went straight through a red light. Literally, I went straight through Cedarhurst Avenue, which is a pretty busy street, and I was lucky there was no one coming the other way. I wasn't speeding, but I was just like, just kept going because I was busy looking behind me. Where is the ambulance up to? And I went straight through the light. Then I pulled over. I'm like, wow, I can't believe I just went through a red light. And then I realized it's true. Every time you have somebody driving on a street with lights and sirens, it's a pikuach nefesh in and of itself. First of all, they're running red lights. They're driving faster than they otherwise would. They're weaving in and out of traffic. And forgetting them, for all the other drivers, it's a pikuach nefesh also, as I just learned with myself as well. So this is really not a scenario that's a perfect scenario. But let's say in theory, what would you say in such a case? Well, let's break it down. On the one hand, the member of Hatzala that's going to pick up his radio, call back to everybody else who's on their way, is violating Shabbos by doing so. But he's doing that in order to save 10 other members from violating Shabbos as they drive to the scene. So it would make sense to me that probably he should get on his radio in order to save them from doing more malach on Shabbos. On the other hand, what's the other side of the argument? On the other hand, yeah. Right. So long as nobody says anything to those people, they think that they are doing a mitzvah. They are not violating Shabbos. And they think that they're going to save a life. Well, it turns out when they get there that there's nothing for them to do and there's no life to be saved. Everybody's okay. But so long as they're going because they think that they're doing so, the Shulchan Aruch seems to say that that in and of itself would be considered a mitzvah. So why would I violate Shabbos by picking up my phone or my radio and letting everybody else know that they should turn around, as opposed to allowing them to do what they're supposed to do? Then they get there and they find out. Now again, as I said, this is not a perfect scenario because there are a million and one reasons to say why you should call back. Maybe there's going to be another Hatzala call and all of these members are not going to be available to do what has to be done because they're busy coming here. You can have a variety of reasons why this is not a perfect case, but in theory it's something that is very interesting. So this is a very involved and complicated question, but again, it comes down to the point that the Shulchan Aruch makes, which is that when one is involved in life-saving activities on Shabbos, or even potentially life-saving activities, we would consider that to be not just something that is allowed, but something that is absolutely encouraged and is considered to be a mitzvah. So much so, one of the most important of the Rishonim, it's hard to rank the Rishonim. I mean, who are we to rank the Rishonim? But it's true. If you look through all of Halacha as we know it, there are some Rishonim that are extremely prominent. For example, the Rush, Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi, the Ramban, the Rashba, the Ritva. There are certain Rishonim that are very prominent, very well known, and very involved in the process of Halacha. And there are others that I'm sure were wonderful as well, but are not listed as prominently in the Halachic discussion. The Ramban certainly is one of them that is considered to be one of the pillars of Halacha as we know it today. And the Ramban says, what if you have somebody who is a chole mesukan, somebody who is really in danger? And he said, he's rotze lehischased, he chooses that he wants to be overly righteous. And he says, you know, I'm supposed to go to the hospital because my life is in danger, but it's Shabbos and I'm not going to do that. Says the Ramban, what do we tell a person like that? Hareze chasidus shel shtus. Says the Ramban, it's like the Gemara says, a chasid shote. Chasid doesn't mean a Hasidic Jew. Chasid means a silly person who thinks that they're being pious. That's not the right thing to do. V'dino kishofech damin. Writes the Ramban, somebody who chooses not to go to the hospital on Shabbos when they know they need to, and they say, you know, I'll suffer the consequence, everything will be fine, and if not, well, that's okay. Says the Ramban, it's as if you are a shofech damin. It's not a choice that you have the right to make. So the Gemara talks about a chassid shote. The example that the Gemara gives is you have a woman who's swimming in a swimming pool somewhere, and a man walks by and he hears that somebody is flailing, somebody is underwater, and he quickly runs into the area where the pool is and he sees that there's a woman in a bathing suit underwater, and he happens to be an expert lifeguard and he knows CPR, he knows how to do anything, but he says, what should I do? You know, I'm a very pious person, and if I go into the water, I'm going to have to look at this woman, and inappropriately, I can't bring myself to do that, and he lets the woman drown. Because he's not willing to compromise on his principles and beliefs. Now, it's a very nice value. It's a nice value in a vacuum. So don't go to the mixed beaches when you're in Miami in the winter. Fine. But if you happen to be somewhere and somebody's life is in danger and you choose because of your religious standards that you're not going to help them, says the Gemara, that's called a chassid shote. That's somebody who doesn't really understand priorities and values. Of course, the Torah values all of us being sanua, all of us being careful, but to a certain degree, to a limit. You can't do it at the expense of somebody else's life. So here the Ramban says, this would be another example. And similarly, the Magen Avraham, one of the most important commentaries on the side of the Shulchan Aruch, writes, in the name of the Radbaz, what if a not Shabbos, what if a doctor insists that a patient needs to have a certain life-saving procedure? And the patient says, you know what, I'm just not interested. And the doctor says, I don't understand, you're 30 years old. You're going to live out the rest of your life. The statistics show that it's a very high rate of cure after you get this procedure done. Why wouldn't you do it? He says, well, you know, it just makes me nervous. I don't like it. Well, are you a doctor? Are you coming with medical knowledge that's telling you not to do that? Or you just feel uncomfortable? Says the Radbaz, kofen oso. In such a situation, nothing to do with Shabbos, we would force a person to take the treatment. Now, of course, legally, you're not allowed to force anyone to do anything. But in theory, says the Radbaz, this doesn't make sense. You have a 30-year-old person who's saying, I don't want this minimally invasive procedure because I just simply don't want it. The Radbaz says, that's an inappropriate choice for me to be making, and that is not something that I'm allowed to do. So as we mentioned, this is not limited to Hilchos Shabbos. This is something that expands way beyond the laws of Shabbos. So let's take, for example, eating on Yom Kippur. Sometimes you have a situation where somebody needs to eat on Yom Kippur, but they don't want to. So what do we do in a situation like that? Let's read together a letter from the Shemi Shmuel. The Shemi Shmuel was one of the great Torah personalities in the early 1900s. He was the son of the Avnei Nezer. Avnei Nezer was the undisputed Gadol HaDor in the late 1800s. And the Avnei Nezer's son was the Shemi Shmuel. At his bris, they did not call him Shem Mishmuel. That was the sefer that he wrote on Chumash. His name was Reb Shmuel Bornstein. And he was really a tremendous Talmud Chacham. And he writes in one of his svarim as follows. He had a son-in-law who was critically sick around the time of Yom Kippur. And he gave very clear directives and instructions to his son-in-law that you need to eat this year on Yom Kippur, otherwise you're putting your life in danger. And his son-in-law was very concerned. His son-in-law was uncomfortable with the psak that his father-in-law gave him. So his father-in-law wrote an open letter to his son-in-law, which was later published, to explain his feelings about this matter. So let's learn it together. Everybody have it? Avol. Ka'asher Yom Kippur memash meshuba. When Yom Kippur is drawing closer and closer to us. Hinini lahazhircha ma'od, I am here to warn you. Lebal titzdak harbe v'dvar hatzom. Don't try to be so righteous when it comes to fasting on Yom Kippur. V'kafi asher yom alacha ha-doctor kein tishmar la'asos. And whatever the doctor tells you to do is exactly what you should do. Im yomru shaddai pachas mikashir, haynu pachas mechatzi beitza b'toch shmona minit. If they tell you that it's enough for you to just eat minimally within a certain amount of time, then great. Ah, however, b'im yomru, if the doctor suggests shegam zeh lo yaspik, If the doctor says, no, you have to eat normally. You need 3 meals a day on Yom Kippur, like on any other day. And you need to have these foods and these vegetables and these drinks. Otherwise, you're really going to be off balance and it's going to offset the medications you're on. Chalila lecha lehachmir. Writes the Shem Yishmuel to his son-in-law, you don't have a right to be machmir in a situation like this. Ki mi shetziva latzum biyom ha-kippurim. And this is the critical line. The same HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the same God that gave us the instruction on a normal year to fast on Yom Kippur, Hu tziva lishmar lerofe v'shalo latzum. That is the same God that also gave us the instruction that we should listen to the doctor and we should not fast when the doctor tells us not to. And don't think this means that the only person that's allowed to eat on Yom Kippur is someone who is going to die on Yom Kippur itself if they don't eat. My father tells the story. He had a friend who was a rabbi, not in the New York area. And he was called before Yom Kippur by a man whose wife is very sick in the hospital. And this man put the doctor on the phone to explain the medical condition of his wife to the rabbi. So that's commonplace. That's the way it should be. And the rabbi was talking to the doctor, trying to get the information. So the rabbi asked the doctor, is the woman going to die if she doesn't eat on Yom Kippur? The doctor said, no, of course she won't die if she doesn't eat on Yom Kippur. So the rabbi said, well then, you should do other things, but I don't think it really makes sense for her to eat on Yom Kippur if it's not going to put her in a situation where her life is in danger. Okay, that's the way they left it. A couple of days after Yom Kippur, the woman died. So the rabbi called back the husband and he said, I feel terrible, what happened? Husband says, I don't know. I was there when you had the whole discussion with the doctor. I was in the room. I'm not sure what went wrong. Well, after a back and forth, they get back on the phone with the doctor and the doctor says, oh, well, I was asked whether she's going to die from not eating. I thought you meant, is she going to die today? Of course, this was going to bring about her demise. She would die 5 days later. But I didn't understand the question. How tragic. And the Shem Yishmuel states the obvious, which is, when we tell somebody that they need to eat on Yom Kippur because they are not well, it doesn't mean that if they don't eat, they're going to die today on Yom Kippur. It means if it's going to negatively impact them in any way, which in the future may cause them to have a demise even 1 second earlier, we would not be allowed to have them fast under such situations, under such conditions. That is the way he explains it. And then he says, Chalila, afilu l'svek sveka, ki ein hochem b'pikuach nefesh achar harov, va'afilu l'zman meruba, she'ein adam yachal hachmer. Even if it means that it's going to negatively impact your health, and 5 years from now, they project you're going to die because of what happened today, still, that is something that would not be allowed. U'petach, zachar tizkar ma'shekvar shemata bimenu harbe pa'amim. Writes the Shem Yishmuel, I am sure you remember what I have told you many times, and that is, she'ikar hayadus. What is the most fundamental principle of being a Jew? Lios ha'adam batel ledas ha'torah v'chachameha. The most important part of being a Jew is to subordinate oneself to the understandings of Torah and of the interpretation of Torah that the Chachamim give over to us. And that, he says, is most important. And therefore he writes that even though the Torah itself says that we should fast on Yom Kippur, he says that is only under certain conditions. But if you're faced with a situation where you are unable to do that, the Chachamim themselves told us that this is what you're supposed to do. And therefore he says, don't feel bad. Look at the last few lines. Ein lecha lehitzdar al im lo tatzum biyom ha-kippurim. Don't feel bad. Don't feel guilty that you're not fasting on Yom Kippur. Ki bameh shatishma ledas chachmei ha-torah shetzivu shelo latzum im yofrei tzivu shelo latzum hu shavar yoser me'ikar atzom. That is worth the same as if you would have fasted. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants you to listen to the Torah and to the Chachamim's interpretation. And therefore he says, don't feel guilty about the fact that you're not going to be able to fast on Yom Kippur this year. You're doing exactly what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants you to do. You know, recently someone sat down with me. They said they wanted to have a meeting. I said, fine. So we met. The meeting was very awkward, in my opinion. They sat down. The first question they asked me is, so what's your 10-year plan? What's your 20-year plan? I thought it was strange. Is that what you came to meet me about? What's my 10-year plan? What's my 20-year plan? If I wanted to talk to you about it, I would have called a meeting with you. But I'm not interested in your opinion about my 10 or 20-year plan. And they were really pushing hard on the fact that I wasn't giving an answer. I said, look, I'll tell you this. Everybody that I respect in the world didn't have a 10-year plan or a 20-year plan. Their plan was that they wake up every day and do what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants them to do. So sometimes it means being involved in this, and sometimes it means doing that. Every day it means something else. It depends what you're presented with. I don't understand why I should have a 10 or 20-year plan. I think it's more important to have a plan to do what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to do, and to use all of our talents, and to use everything that He gave us to further Kiddush Hashem in this world. That's my 10-year plan, I told him. And that, says the Shem Yishmuel, is what all of us are supposed to do. You can look in the Pesukim and Chumash and conjure up in your mind what you think the life of a perfect Jew is supposed to look like. But it doesn't always work that way. Sometimes you have a situation where it doesn't pan out the way you expected it to. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, at that juncture in your life, expects something very different out of you. And that is our job. That's our duty, to do just that when we're in those circumstances and when we are faced with those kinds of situations. And that's not something to feel guilty about. I remember at my wedding, Rav Asher Weiss came in from Eretz Yisrael to our wedding. And I don't know what happens on the women's side during dancing. Do you ever notice, I don't know if you do this, but do you ever notice that when the Kala or the Chasna are dancing with people, people whisper into their ears, tell them all kinds of things? Yeah? I always wondered, what's everybody saying? I don't know. Do you say it to your friends, or it's only older people say it to the Kala? I guess everyone's in agreement. You don't really know what to say, right? So I never say anything. I wish Mazel Tov. I wish them well. But I'm always wondering, like, what are these conversations that are going on there? So at my wedding, everybody had what to say. I couldn't hear anybody. It was very loud. There were a lot of people. But Rav Asher Weiss pulled me aside and he said, listen, you're going to think I'm crazy, but you're a yeshiva guy. You've never been married. You don't know what relationships are all about. You don't know what leading a family is all about and having to juggle many different kinds of responsibilities. I know as a boy in yeshiva, you cannot imagine ever davening without a minyan. Why would you? But just remember, there are going to be times in your marriage when your shalom bayis is going to dictate that you stay home, that you don't daven with the minyan. And I thought it was so interesting. Of all the things to tell me at my wedding, that's what he chose to talk about. And it's true. Obviously, minyan is very important, but sometimes it's not what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from you. Now, you have to have a dose of Yirah Shamayim to really be honest with yourself. When is it appropriate and when is it not? My wife always jokes, whatever time it is in the year, summer or winter, the minute the kids need to go in the bath, it's time for mincha. So in the winter time, it could be 4:15, in the summertime, it's 7:30. Doesn't matter. It's time for mincha. Why is it always time for mincha when the kids need to have a bath and get into pajamas and be put to sleep? It's a strange phenomenon. Well, what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu want from us? The answer is, at every moment, we need to judge and evaluate the situation and the circumstances that we face, and we need to ask ourselves, what is the proper Torah reaction to this situation? What does HaKadosh Baruch Hu want from me? There's not one formula that can be plugged into every single situation. Sometimes it varies and sometimes it changes. And therefore, he says, the same is by somebody who's confronted with a situation where it comes to Yom Kippur and they're unable to fast. It's not something to feel bad about. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants you to look at every scenario in your life and evaluate carefully how you're supposed to react and how you're supposed to respond. And not every year is Yom Kippur going to be observed in the same way. And that's fine. Nothing to feel bad about. There's someone in my shul who said, you know, I have two sons. One son works on Shabbos and one son drives on Yom Kippur. He said one of his sons is a rabbi and the other son is a member of Hatzalah. And he's very proud of it. He's very proud of it. And I said, you should be proud. Eim habanam smecha. You know, what can be better? You have children who are saving lives, even if it means driving on Yom Kippur, as uncomfortable as it makes you feel. And you have another son who's a rabbi. He's working on Shabbos. It's great. It's beautiful. And they should all continue to do what they're supposed to do. So this is what he writes. And he ends off the letter by saying, uvechein, and therefore, leich echol b'simcha lachmecha u'sheseh b'leiv tov yenecha, ki kvar ratza ha'elokim es ma'asecha. The most important value in all of Torah is we need to remember to ask ourselves that question. What is it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants of me now when I face this set of circumstances, this scenario that I'm confronted with? It's not always going to be the same answer, and we have to educate ourselves enough to know the right answer or to surround ourselves with people that can help us find those answers, but it's a question we need to ask. In fact, there's a beautiful sefer called Toras Hayoledes. Toras Hayoledes is an interesting sefer written by Anybody know? Why would you know? Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein. Torah Sayuledes, as it sounds, is a book all about everything one needs to know when they are pregnant and after they give birth. What can a person be confronted with? What can possibly come up? So he goes through a whole array of issues, everything under the sun, and he puts it all together in a sefer called Torah Sayuledes. Now we know that a Yoledes, a woman who just gives birth, within the first couple of days after giving birth, she's not allowed to fast. And that is not only Tisha B'Av, Asar B'Teves, Tzom Gedalia, and Tanis Esther, that is also on Yom Kippur. It's a sakana. It's a danger for a woman to fast within 3 days of having a baby. And therefore we assume if a woman has a baby within a couple of days of Yom Kippur, she's not supposed to fast. Okay. So he writes that there is a passage that he found in the old Machzorim. And they write the following. Let's read it together. They write that before a woman eats or drinks on Yom Kippur, because she just had a baby, she should say the following. Hineni muchan umezuman lekayim mitzvas achila ushtia b'yom kippur. How interesting. Anybody here say hineni muchan umezuman before they do a mitzvah? Anybody have that practice? Wow. So it's more from those who come from Hasidic origin, that they have the minhag that before they observe a mitzvah, they say a little paragraph in the Siddur that says, "Hineni muchan umezuman, I'm designating my thoughts and I'm making sure that I'm focusing on the mitzvah I'm about to do." Okay, most of us seemingly do not have that practice, but that's what often we find in many Siddurim, before you shake lulav, before you light Hanukkah candles, before you do many different things. Okay, here he writes that before a woman who's not well and has to eat on Yom Kippur, before she eats, she should say the following. Hineni muchan umezuman lekayim mitzvas achila ushtia b'yom kippurim kemo shekasavta b'sorasecha ushmartem eschukosai ves mishpatai asher yasa osa ha'adam v'chai bahem. And in the schus, in the merit of this mitzvah that I'm doing, of saving my life, of eating on Yom Kippur, tachto mosi ves kol cholei ama Yisrael l'refuah shleima ve'eske b'yom kippurim haba, I should be able to have the privilege next year on Yom Kippur Lekayim, to be able to observe the mitzvah of V'inisem es nafsho seichem, to observe Yom Kippur the way it's supposed to be observed. But this year, I'm not able to do that, and I say, Hineni muchan umezuman, here I am, not feeling guilty, not feeling bad, feeling very proud that I am now about to embark on a journey of observing the mitzvah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants me to do this year. Ken yihi ratzon amen. I've always found that to be such a beautiful tefillah, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes in one of his svarim, do we feel bad when we have a bris milah that falls out on Shabbos? We don't feel guilty. We don't push it off to Sunday. We do it on Shabbos, b'simcha. Why? Because that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. Says Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, then why do I feel guilty or bad when I have to eat on Yom Kippur if the circumstances expect that of me? What's the difference? It's the same thing. And that really is very important for us to frame exactly what it is that our perspective should be when we go into a situation like this. There was a great tzaddik, Hashem Yinkom Damo. His name was Rabbi Sachar Bernard Davids. And he was the rabbi in Bergen-Belsen. I don't know how many of you have been to the camps, but Bergen-Belsen was obviously one of the more famous ones. And Bergen-Belsen in 1944, he passed away. And he made a psak in 1944 before Pesach that all the Jews in Bergen-Belsen who were emaciated because they were obviously undernourished, he told them that they all have to eat chametz bePesach. Every day they were given a little scrap of bread. It's probably not really edible anyway. But he said, since this is all we have to eat, everybody has to follow the instructions and eat chametz bePesach. They found later on this piece of paper that you see here. If you Google it, you can see it in its original form. Like, it's like a colorful, it's like a yellow piece of paper. You can find it. It's fascinating to look at it. So here it's not in color, but you'll see. He writes the following: Lefnei achilas chametz, yomar bekavanas alev. He wrote on a scrap of paper that he had in Bergen-Belsen, after instructing all the members of the camp to eat on Yom Kippur. So he tells them, before you eat chametz on Yom Kippur, on Pesach, you should say bekavanas alev. You should say with great intensity, Avinu shabashamayim. You know that it really is our wish to do what you want us to do. And the way that we generally observe Pesach is, we don't eat chametz and we eat matzah. And we would love to do that this year. However, achal zos dava libenu, how unfortunate it is, shehashibud ma'akev osanu, va'anachnu nimtzayim b'sakanas nefashos. And therefore he says, hinenu muchanim umuzumanim, l'kayim mitzvosecha v'chay bahem, v'lizayir me'al zerosecha hishamar lecha reshmanafshecha miyod, alkein tfilaseinu, and as a result of this mitzvah that we are all doing, we ask you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, shetechayenu, uskaimenu, usge'alenu b'mehera, lishmarchu kecha, v'lasos ritzoncha, l'avdecha v'leiv havshalem, amen. Again, another variation of this very beautiful idea that when a person is forced into a situation where they need to observe a particular mitzvah in a very different way than they anticipated. For example, eating on Yom Kippur, eating chametz on Pesach, being mechal Shabbos because I have to take care of somebody who's not well, any of the above situations, one should not feel guilty about it. One should pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that this should be a schus, as I'm doing exactly what it is that you want me to do. Shulchan Aruch writes that when you have a situation of pikuach nefesh on Shabbos, harzariz harezem eshubach, someone who is quick to take care of it, someone who tries to get involved and be on top of the situation, should be praised. Vehashoel, but somebody who, when faced with a situation of pikuach nefesh, decides to go running around asking a question, whether or not they should drive to the hospital, whether or not they should do this or that, harezeh shofech damin. Shulchan Aruch says, harezeh shofech damin. It's tantamount to murder. In what way? Because unfortunately, we all know that sometimes seconds and minutes count. The difference between life and death can sometimes be seconds. And if you choose to start running around and asking a question and trying to figure out and looking up in the svarim, writes the Shulchan Aruch, Hareza Shofech Damit. Writes the Mishneh Berurah, V'hanishal. What does that mean? Who's Hanishal? I'm sorry? The person who the question was posed to. Meaning Hashoel is the one who goes around to ask a question. Hanishal is the one who the question was asked to. So what's my status? What would you say? What? Right. So what's wrong? What did I do? Mishneh Berurah says, Harezeh Meguneh. Shame on the rabbi who is asked such a question on Shabbos. What did I do wrong? Why am I to be blamed? So why is it that Hanishal Harezeh Meguneh? My father told me many, many times that the answer is because it means you're a lousy rabbi. If your community doesn't know on their own, just from knowing you, that the greatest value in our community is human life, and they even have a shemetz of a suffix, they even have room for doubt of how they should respond and how they should react to a situation that it presents itself on Shabbos, when someone's life is in danger, yes, shame on you, Rabbi, that your community doesn't know the answer. So my father said, well, maybe it means that they weren't at the shir that day. Maybe they missed it when I spoke about pikuach nefesh. The answer is, that should be the first shir that you give. That has to be the first thing that you teach, which is why we're beginning Hilchos Shabbos with this. Because everybody needs to know this. Everybody needs to know that the most important value in our community is human life itself. And even if it's at odds with Hilchos Shabbos itself, human life will obviously take precedence. And we need to do everything to try and encourage people to be able to save a life as best as we possibly can. I once asked I remember exactly who the rabbi was, that there was somebody in his shul who was Mechal Shabbos unjustifiably. Really, it was just unjustified for the person who did it. And they asked my father, How should we advise this person to do tshuva? My father said, the person doesn't do tshuva, the rabbi needs to do tshuva. Because it's the fault of the rabbi that he didn't teach it clearly enough. That people don't know on their own that this is what needs to be done, that this is how we react, that this is how we need to respond. Now, that being the case, although it's true, we're going to end in a few minutes, although it's true that we're allowed to be Mechal Shabbos when Pikuach Nefesh presents itself, we need to do everything we can, writes the Magen Avraham, to prevent Chilul Shabbos in advance. So the Magen Avraham says, if you have a woman who knows that she's in her ninth month, and it's a very high likelihood that she's going to have a baby in the coming hours, then she has to do everything that she can to try and limit the amount of Chilul Shabbos as much as possible. So you'll say that this is extreme, and I'm not saying that this is what everybody should do, but when we were expecting our first child, it's very different when you have a couple of children at home, and it's not so simple to just make arrangements for them every Shabbos. But when we were expecting our first child, so in the ninth month, a woman has to have a checkup every week by the doctor. So we made the checkups on Erev Shabbos. Every Erev Shabbos of the ninth month was the time that my wife went for a checkup. And the doctor can tell you, not with certainty, but they can tell you what's going on. Are you dilated? Is anything moving? Does it seem like this is going to happen anytime soon? Now, of course, we all know doctors can be wrong and things can happen unexpectedly, but there's a likely chance that with your first child in particular, when labor takes much longer than subsequent children, there's a very high likelihood that if you get checked on Friday afternoon, the doctor tells you there's nothing happening yet, it would seem that that is a high likelihood that nothing is going to happen in the next 24 hours. Of course, it's not foolproof. Of course, it's not always the case. So for the first 4 weeks of the ninth month, my wife went to the doctor on Erev Shabbos and nothing happened. Then, once she was overdue, we actually stayed for Shabbos by the hospital, by LIJ. So we called up somebody who we know there, who was actually a doctor in LIJ, and we stayed by them for Shabbos. So the first Shabbos we stayed there, it was wonderful, nothing happened. Second Shabbos overdue, we stayed there again. And that time, my wife's water broke on Erev Shabbos, and we went into the hospital on Friday, signed all the papers before Shabbos, and we were so happy. You know, look, we did it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu paid us back, gave us a Shabbos baby, which, by the way, if you ever have a choice to do a Shabbos baby or not, which you don't, is just so beautiful. It's nice. Spend time with your spouse when, like, nobody's calling you and nobody's texting you and nobody else knows. It's just very nice and private. So we felt that that was like a schar of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that we were able to have a baby on Friday night without 1 ounce of Chilul Shabbos. And everything went smoothly. Everything was great. Baruch Hashem, b'liyayin hara. And then, after my wife gave birth, so one of the first things that they need to do is to make sure that all the identification is in order, right? So how do they identify a baby? Nobody knows? So first of all, they put, obviously, something around the leg of the baby, with identification, with the last name. But outside of that, they also take a fingerprint of the baby, or a footprint, and they put it into the ink, and they put it onto the paper, so that they can match it later on, should there ever be any question that arises. Okay, aside from that, they also do a fingerprinting of the mother. And they put that on the same piece of paper so that they can match it up later. Okay, so here we are Friday night. Baby was just born. Not 1 ounce of Chilul Shabbos. 6 weeks, we're anticipating no Chilul Shabbos, and it worked out. Of course, we would have gone to the hospital had we had to. But we did everything in our power to make sure we didn't have to. And it was amazing. Here we are. After she has the baby, the nurse comes in and says, okay, I need to take your fingerprint. I said, now, this is when we're going to break Shabbos. Fingerprinting. So you'll say, what's the malach of fingerprinting on Shabbos? What would you say? What? Kosev? What do you say? What is it? What? Soveya, coloring. So it's not really colorful. It's, just black ink. So would you call that Soveya? Soveya means when I'm like painting something, right? So is that really Soveya? So like, where is this? You can't say it's Ksiva because I'm not really writing something. Maybe we'll talk about it at some point, but Ksiva is really when Kosev Shtei Osios. The Mishnah says you have to write two letters. So this is certainly not writing. So what is it? So this is actually a tshuva. Anyone here ever heard of the Rogatchever? He was one of the great geniuses in Europe before the Holocaust. So the Rogatchever says that it used to be the custom in many communities in Europe that on Shabbos afternoon, the policemen would walk up and down the streets, and at random, they would pick people off the streets and tell them to do a fingerprint. He calls it in Yiddish a finger druk, which is a fingerprint. They used to basically take your hand, put it in the ink, and they would take your fingerprint to just check up on your history, whatever it was. So he asks, what do you do if you're asked to do that on Shabbos? Fascinating question. And he writes that this is what the Rambam means when he talks about the malach of ksiva. He writes, ksiva is not only if you write letters, ksiva is also what we refer to as roshem. If I make some kind of nice picture, even if it's not writing letters, it's still considered to be ksiva. That's the same malacha. You're trying to get a desired result by what it is that you're doing, and you are actually making that happen by the activity that you're involved with now. And this would be no different, says the Rogatchever. When I take my finger, put it in the ink, and then I have a beautiful picture of my fingerprint on the piece of paper, that would be a malacha of roshem. That would be a subcategory of Dimalacha b'kosei b'shabbos. So I said to the nurse, no, you know, we're not doing this. And she says to me, like, what's your issue? What's your problem? I said, you know, my wife is really exhausted. Can you do it for her? She's like, yeah, sure. I said, she's totally not paying attention. She's out of it, but she wasn't. So the nurse comes along, no problem, not a big deal, takes her finger, puts it in the ink, puts it on the thing, great. Now I'm thinking to myself, well, is that true? Does that really work? There's actually a discussion between the Shachar and the Thousand Year a Day in Hilchos Nida, where he talks about what happens if a woman has to go to the mikvah on Friday night. I wasn't like giving the shiur in the hospital. I was going along with the program. But this became a big discussion on Sunday morning in Yeshiva. So what happens if a woman has to go to the mikvah on Friday night, and we know that the minhag is, in order to avoid chatzitza, a woman's supposed to cut her nails before going to the mikvah. What happens if a woman comes Friday night and forgot to cut her nails? Did I say, what's so funny? What? So it's a big discussion. What are you supposed to do if you go to the mikvah Friday night and you forgot to cut your nails? So I forgot if it's the Shach or the Taz. One of them suggests just have a non-Jew take a nail clipper and cut the nails. What's a big deal? Amir la'akum. You're allowed to do amir la'akum amakum mitzvah. You know, if it's a very important situation, under certain conditions, of course. So he says that perhaps what you should do is have a non-Jew come, cut the nails, and then go to the mikvah. What's the big deal? Now, that's pretty uncomfortable also, to have somebody else cut your fingernails. I mean, I guess if you go for a manicure, then you're used to it. But for me, I would be very uncomfortable, I don't know, having my nails cut by somebody else. But be it as it may, that's what he writes. And the other one, I forgot if it's the Shach or the Taz, one or the other says, no, that wouldn't work. Why? Because when I say that Amir La'akum is sometimes permissible on Shabbos, Makom Mitzvah, Makom Mitzvah Derabim, certain important exceptions where we would say it's allowed, that is only when the Nachri, when the non-Jew is doing some kind of malacha, he's turning on the lights in Shul. Why? Because we have no lights in Shul. What are we going to do? Nobody can daven. He's getting something out of my car that I left the inside of the car on Shabbos because everybody has to eat Suda Shabbos. We forgot the challah in the car, so what are we going to do? So the non-Jew goes and does it for me. However, when it's a malacha begufo, when the non-Jew is doing a malacha on my body, you can't say that it's an independent act. It's something that is happening to me, with me. And therefore he says, you wouldn't be allowed to ask a non-Jew to cut your nails. It's as if you are actively participating in that malacha. So I said to myself, well, this is really a machlokes to Shach and the Taz. Because over there by Hilchos Nida, they wonder whether or not the woman would be allowed to stick out her fingers to have the non-Jew cut them in order to enable her to go to the mikvah. What about over here? I'm basically sticking out my hand, having the non-Jew put my hand into the ink, put it onto the piece of paper. Would that really circumvent the issue? Or would you say, no, that is a malacha begufo? It's the same scenario as is described by the Shach and the Taz, and maybe that would be in question as well. Okay, everybody did okay with it. Everything was fine, but just an interesting discussion nonetheless. And I think what's important about this as well is this is not only something that is limited to the story of Achola B'Shabbos, to the story of Achola B'Yom HaKippurim, to the story of Achola on Pesach, who also has to eat. There is a very relevant topic that comes up with regard to Rosh Hashanah as well. And we're going to close with this because I know it's late and I know that these air conditioners also seem not to be working. So I feel very sorry for all of you. There is a discussion. Anybody here ever heard of the Maharam Shik? Yeah? Maharam Shik. Which era did he live in? It's not a trick. I think it's valuable when we learn halacha to actually get a context of who the players, not players, who the personalities are. And to know when they lived and who they're arguing with, what's the discussion. The Maharam Shik was the most important student of the Chasam Sofer. Chasam Sofer was one of the most important leaders in European Jewry in the early 1800s. Chasam Sofer and Rabbi Kiva Eiger were two of the most important leaders then, and the greatest, most outstanding Talmud of the Chasam Sofer was undoubtedly the Maharam Shik. So the Maharam Shik has a Tshuva Sefer that is called Tshuva's Maharam Shik, where he discusses the following. You have a chole who is told that he's not allowed to eat matzah and maror on Pesach. And that chola decides, I'm going to defy the orders of the doctors, I'm going to eat anyway. So he says, Asur levarich. He's not allowed to make a bracha on the matzah or the marah because he's doing something that is wrong. So, this is the discussion that he has. How far do we take it? So, he says, Asur levarich. Okay. Big discussion in the poskim. Is it Asa Levarach or not? Based on that, the Minchas Yitzchak, who lived in our generation, one of the great Gedolim in Yerushalayim, writes in one of his tshuvas, what happens if you have somebody who's been the Baal Tokeya in Shul for 50 years? Excellent Baal Tokeya, the one who blows the shofar. And the doctors say, you know, look, you have a real pulmonary issue. You are not healthy enough to blow the shofar this year. You can't. You're going to get out of breath. You're perhaps going to faint. You're going to pass out. It's very dangerous. We're worried for your health. Would we tell that person that he has a right to take a chance? He takes so much pride in his tkiyah shofar. So he writes, Lo yatsa yedei chavaso. If he ends up defying the doctor's orders and blowing the shofar anyway, Lo yatsa yedei chavaso. He would not be yotze his mitzvah. He refers to it as a mitzvah above the avera. And he says, not only that, the tzibur, the congregation, the community that tried to fulfill their mitzvah obligation by listening to his shofar, also has not fulfilled their obligation. It's as if this person wasn't here. He had no right to do it. He should not have defied the orders of the doctor. And as a result of what he did, none of us were mekayim the mitzvah. I find that to be a fascinating psak. So it was not just something that is with regard to eating matzah, eating on Yom Kippur, eating chametz bePesach, being mechal Shabbos to take care of a chola. It really spills over to many other situations, as one could imagine. If the doctors advise somebody that for whatever reason it's negative to their health to be involved in whatever activity that the person wants to do, it's important that the person go along with what the doctor's request is. And if they don't, there are many achronim who say that you have violated the principle of mitzvah baba avera. Not only that, you are not even mekayim the mitzvah even if you do it anyway. Not only you, but those who wanted to be yotze with you are also not mekayim the mitzvah. So again, a very interesting and robust debate and discussion that really spills over to many other areas of halacha. This is just the introduction to this very important sugya.